morning. Let me call the Mesa City Council study session of Thursday, March 27th. Now that we have a quorum to order. We have seven items this morning. We also have some council members-elect joining us for the budget sessions portion. The first is to hear presentation and discuss arts and cultural department budget issues.
Thank you, Mayor. Good morning. Glad we're following stage cues and things here. It's appropriate today. For the rest of the show, let me just introduce the rest of my cast members. We have Mr. Randy Vogel, who's the arts director, artistic director of the Mesa Art Center. Next to him, Rob Schultz, who is the assistant director in the Department of Arts and Culture. Dr. Tom Wilson, director of the Arizona Museum for Natural History. And Sonny Spencer, director for Arizona Museum for Youth. Terry Siggins next to me is our budget person. He's going to help me with the presentation. And just to provide some comic relief, I brought the budget director, Chuck Odom, today.
That's how we feel about him, too.
Thank you for giving us this opportunity. We wanted to start by just giving you some background of the arts and culture as a department. As most of you know, it consists of the three institutions that I just mentioned. And as a department, we've worked on defining a holistic picture for the city of Mesa, which is more than the sum of its parts. And so in a very brief description about what we do, we will refer to slide one, where we basically say that in addition to great services and reliance on infrastructure and other services, the citizens of Mesa desire, expect, and deserve a high quality of life. And the Arts and Culture Department, through our world-class programs and facilities, offer ample opportunities for families and visitors from all over the country and actually all over the world to come and be engaged, entertained, and be educated through our great programs and facilities. This affords the city of Mesa some extraordinary exposure nationally and internationally and distinguishes us from the rest of the cities in the valley through our unique offering and our diverse offering, which covers a very wide spectrum of experiences all in one arts and culture campus within walking distance in the downtown area. The Arts and Culture Department, through our activities, also plays a crucial role in building a stronger economy. We'll talk about that a little in the presentation. And it creates a more creative community and a strong future for the city of Mesa. We've been working towards a vision. Let me just help my colleague here to press the button. We've been defining a common future for arts and culture, as I said, and we've been working in the last few months to do that. This really coincides with a point in time in the history of Mesa. It is a city with very strong roots and a very strong past and a very strong DNA, and as all living creatures, the city is a living creature and cannot move away from its DNA, but it also evolves. And I think a moment in time, 10, 15 years ago, there was a bold vision of a new and reinvigorated Mesa, which, amongst others, resulted in the building of a new art center. So that sense of ambition in redefining a new Mesa was articulated very strongly, very boldly, and very clearly. People might not associate the word Renaissance with Mesa, but I have to tell you that the Mesa that I see now and the Mesa that I experienced since I came here seems to be a very different Mesa from what people described to me only 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Things are changing, things are moving, things are developing in very exciting ways, which can only be described as a Renaissance. That brings with it a sense of possibilities, which is very exciting, and our future will be limited or determined by our vision collectively. As we develop an identity for the city into the future, it will also make our regional distinction stronger. And there are some elements that are completely unique in this particular city. And I just think that it's important to keep following the momentum, and that's what we as an arts and culture department feel we can play a role in. We define arts and culture very broadly, simply for the sake of this kind of discussion. Culture is who we are, how we live, how we dress, how we speak, the language we use, what sports we do, enjoy, how we worship, or how we worship sports, and how we get married, and the languages we use. And these elements combine to form common cultures, but they also distinguish cultures. The arts is simply how we express our culture. Sometimes we do that by song, by writing, or indeed by doing plays or performances. Beethoven expressed himself through music, so did John Denver. That doesn't make one better than the other. They just expressed themselves through the art of music. That's arts and culture in its basic form. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about this department. The role that we see ourselves playing in this community is to be both a mirror and a window. We believe we should reflect. It's our responsibility as a community art center to reflect all parts of this community. All citizens should see themselves in what we do, find something that they can identify with, that they can develop an affinity for, and that they could see their own culture being embraced and empowered. But we also have a responsibility to be a window, to open to new possibilities, new dreams, new hopes, and offer a window both on our past and our future, but also a new creative way of looking at today. It's also our role to energize dialogue. We don't expect people to come and experience anything we offer and go home with absolutely nothing to say about it, or that it doesn't linger somewhere in the discussion or in the shared memory. We certainly want to energize dialogue and make people talk about who we are and what we want to become. And we want to build a role very strongly is to build and to serve communities. Moving on to the vision slide, then, this is all articulated in a Mesa Arts and Culture vision, which is expressed in these four words: engage, entertain, educate everybody. It's not a sentence. It's specifically articulated in this way because it implies very strongly a two-way street. We want to engage and be engaged. We want to entertain, be entertained, educate and be educated. But the most important word for us is everybody. Being a community art center and being funded by the citizens of Mesa, that's really important for us, and we continue to work towards that. So everything we do will be informed by those four words. Of course, each of the entities have their own visions. But that's the collective. Some of the opportunities that we see, and I've identified just some of them on the next slide for you, so that you can see what we're grappling with and what energizes us. Perceptions change all the time in all communities. That's no new thing. These perceptions might be political perceptions, historic perceptions, cultural perceptions, financial perceptions, perceptions of whether arts should or should not be playing the role that it is here. And all of that really is a challenge that offers us the great opportunity to communicate. And we're working really hard to find all the various platforms we can to continually communicate this role that we feel the arts can and should play in this community. By doing so, we will earn the social capital that is so needed. In a way, I think social capital is more important than financial capital because the one does build the other. Without social capital, we will not get any funding because we will simply not earn it or deserve it. We need to earn the buy-in from people, not just to support us, but to believe in what we do and to show us what they want and what they want us to continue doing. In other words, relevance is important and will always be important. Gives us a great opportunity to show whether we are or not relevant and to measure the impact we have on the community. So we need to deliver to be able to show that we are on track. Access is a really important opportunity for us. The new art center, just to speak about that for a moment, is a world-class, wonderful facility, but can run the risk of becoming painted by the perception of exclusivity, of a space that is less accessible for the communities by virtue of some of the costs involved in renting the space or using the space. We need to be sensitive to that. Every taxpayer pays for this space, not only those who can afford high fees to come to classes or concerts. So we are obviously very sensitive constantly about the idea that everybody in, nobody out. We feel strongly about that. So all our programs will have a component to address the access issue. But all of that has to be underlined by a strong bottom line, obviously, and we'll talk about that for the remainder of my presentation. I know that's the fun part you've been waiting for. Financial sustainability is a challenge we enjoy. It's something that I think we are moving in the right direction on very strongly. It's not only about increasing revenue, but that's certainly a focus initially for us, and then to continue to trend our efficiencies and measure it in a number of ways, which we have started. Moving now to the financial issues of next year, 08-09, as a department of arts and culture, we were given a target of 5% of the general fund of $191,000 to cut from next year's operations. We decided to attack this challenge as a department and not just as three institutions. And the summary slide just quickly tells you we've been able to adjust the budget of the MAC by $130,000, which will reduce our reliance on the general fund transfers. The Arizona Museum for Natural History will adjust its budget by $43,000, and the Arizona Museum for Youth by $19,000, totaling $192,000. To get into a little bit more detail on it, and of course there'll be time for questions later, and I will pass questions on to the team behind me, so if I were you, I wouldn't ask questions. Believe me, I know. The adjustments we made at the Mesa Arts Center to total the $130,000 is briefly pointed in the four bullets you see there on the next slide. We've been able to reduce expenditure on our postage line item in marketing by $40,000 because of two reasons. One is we found an allocation that was completely underutilized in the past, and we were able to just do without it, which wouldn't affect services. And the second is we're going to go virtual with a lot of our communication in an increasing way. We've just sent out a survey, or we're just about to do it, to ask our 70 or 75,000 supporters who get our annual brochure whether they want the brochure in hard print in future or whether they would be happy with an interactive web-based brochure which cuts down on postage and printing and so on. So that's supporting that line. We will also reduce the overall marketing budget by 4,000. That was just really to get to the 192. It's a small number. It won't really affect the operations there. We will reduce security expenditure by 55, which we have discussed with the PD and is part of the whole story all the way up. And the same with facility maintenance. In other words, we're telling those two departments we need less services and we'll cover the gaps in other ways in our operations without reducing standards of operation in the coming years. The next slide then goes into details about how we've handled the cut or the adjustments at the Natural History Museum. It's a slightly complicated slide, but I did want to take the opportunity to show you how we get to what we did. The underlying policy adjustment here, which I appreciate the support from both the city management and the budget office, is that we, over the past 2 years, have shown that we can deliver revenues far in excess of the budgeted revenue number. And quite simply put, we're asking to share some of that excess in the next budgets and adjust the budgets upwards. And I'll just quickly talk you through it. The 05-06 first line is just historic. That was before the cuts a few years ago. The budgeted earned revenue was 236. The actual for that year end was 346. After the cut, the budgeted earned revenue was reduced a little bit by the budget office to 231. The actual last year, actual earned revenue was 426, the yellow number or the one in the little box. So clearly a very, very good achievement based on management changes, on ways of operating differently, on ways of leveraging the possibility of blockbuster exhibits, on developing a very strong volunteer program, and on beginning stronger fundraising programs. So there's some intrinsic ongoing changes that the Arizona Museum for Natural History and some of the supplies to the Arizona Museum for Youth made, which will not be only for next year. It'll be for next year onwards. So I think these are numbers that we can rely on. The current year that we're in, the budgeted earned revenue is 325. Again, you can see it's gone up almost by 100,000 in the budget side simply because of the good performance last year. We project that we'll end the year at 400, but I think Tom Wilson will tell you that he's confident it'll be quite a lot higher than that. I'm not going to ask him to give you a number now, but it will be higher than 400 at the end of this year. So going to the year under discussion, 08-09, the current budgeted revenue in the budget book is 344,000. We project we'll end at least at 430,000 next year at the year end. The difference between those two is 86,000, and we're asking the city for 50%, and we're willing to give 50% into, and we've been allowed to do that. We have a strong agreement, which Chris put a finer point on in the last budget meeting, to say that the city takes the first 50%. Somehow I knew he would say that, but there it is. The benefits from this adjustment will obviously increase our financial sustainability, and the important thing about this is it will continue to support our ability to generate even more revenue. I think we're showing in the last 2-3 years that we're serious about this and we can do it, and we've made some deep changes that are permanent changes. Just this month, Tom shared with us yesterday that the museum this month will probably hit the second highest monthly revenue ever, and the highest March ever was Sue. And we know what a big world figure Sue was, and we're going to hit that figure or equal it, Tom, right? This month. So I think the underlying factors to support such a prediction of a higher revenue is strong and reliable into the future. It also enables us to retain core staff and core business, which is what drives this revenue, and to develop our capacity to improve on some of our services, which is always a good idea. The next slide talks about the same issues regarding the Arizona Museum for Youth. I won't need to go into the detail because it's laid out in exactly the same way. On that slide, you can see that last year the Arizona Museum for Youth's budgeted expectation was 50,000, clearly an unnaturally low expectation from the city, simply because I think there was a real sense of insecurity after the cuts with that the Museum of Youth might not make more than 50 or would even struggle to get to that number. Well, they turned around and showed that they're made of different stuff, and brought in 213,000 last year, which was even more than before the cut, which is a huge achievement. And in the case of both museums, completely attributed to staff efforts and creativity. This year, we'll end at about 250 against a budget of 162. And next year, we're projecting, based on the numbers I've just shared, that we'll end at least at 210 conservatively, which will yield 38 more than Chuck has in the budget, which gives us a 50-50 split of 19. That's how we arrive to the figures that I've just mentioned of the two museums, which totals the 131. The next slide is year-to-date comparison of the whole Arts and Culture Department on the two metrics that you'll find in the balanced scorecard. We're obviously very excited and proud of this achievement. Last year-to-date, we brought in $2.9 million in revenue, and this year-to-date, we're at $3.9 million revenue, a 33% increase for departments who have gone through pretty tough challenges, just like the city has, and are really taking this bull by the horns to bring in another million into the city coffers. I think is an achievement not to be underestimated. And again, I attribute that to the staff behind me and the people they represent, and my predecessor, Jerry Fathauer. Great work, and I believe the intrinsics are in place to continue to work like this. Will we bring in another million every year? Of course not. But we're moving in that direction and committed to keep doing that. The next slide shows you the same achievement in terms of participation. And again, a great trend. In 06-07, collectively brought in 228,000 participants who, these are either people who attend exhibits, who attend shows, or participate in classes. And this year, year-to-date, that's 45,000 more, which is about a 20% increase so far. Just moving along, so if you have questions later, we can come back if you want to. The next slide is an effort to try and show, basically for me and for management, to see whether the city is spending more or less on what we do vis-a-vis the public sector and our supporters. So for the Mac, the years that I'm comparing is the old Mac and the new Mac actuals of last year. So that's 03, 04 and 06, 07. I'm skipping 05, 06 simply because that was the first year of Mac. It was half a year of operation, not numbers you can compare apples and apples. In the old Mac, in the last year of full operations, the city covered 83% of the old Mac's revenue, and the Mac itself covered through earned and contributed 17%. So the ratio was 83-17. That ratio last year was 59-41. So clearly we're moving in a very strong direction of both at box office and through support of the private sector through the very hard work done by our foundation to get fundraising really established. We bring about $600,000 a year through that that effort. And of course, not to be forgotten, the MAC alone has 500 volunteers which contribute more than $600,000 worth of savings to the city, all part of our budget plan, which we and the city should be thankful for. It's huge community buy-in to what we do. Since the MAC opened, the volunteers have saved us more than $1.6 million. The Natural History Museum and the Youth Museum, I've compared the year before the cut and the year after the cut. Again, those are good places to see what was the old model like and what's the new model like. And again, you can see the ratio went from, in Natural History, from 86-14 to 77-23. A good increase, and the same with AMI, both moving in the right direction. Our projections for this year, which is not on the slide because I wanted to do apples and apples only, but our projections for this year shows that we're still going in that same direction in all three of these institutions. Not by these margins, but I think it was important for everybody, especially the public, to understand that compared to the old days, the city in relation to the public is contributing less than it did before. The last slide I just thought I would bring up here, because it's not a Mesa Arts and Culture Department slide, it's a Mesa Arts Center slide. But again, an issue which I know is important, that's the cost recovery. And again, just to give you a sense of comparison, the last year in the old MAC, those three classes, the youth adult classes, the youth classes, and stage work recovered respectively 50, 38, and 4% of costs. Currently, without the foundation contributions, they are at 71, 56, and 48, which are huge increases in cost recovery compared to the old MAC. And with the great support of the Mesa Arts Center Foundation, chaired by Dennis here, the foundation will bring that number conservatively year-end. Our projections for the two youth programs, which they support, up to 95 and 90%. It might be a little bit higher, but I always project conservatively. So that's just a brief overview of that issue, which I know is also an important issue. I'll be happy to take questions if there are any questions. Thank you.
Let me start out with a couple, and I'm on page 4 of the slides, the Arizona Museum of Natural History, and then you talk about budgeted earned revenue, and then the actual earned revenue, and a budget number, especially I guess when you go to the Arizona Museum for Youth, if you plug in a low number, you have no downside, because then the way this is created, if you just project that we're going to crash next year, and then, oh, gee, we didn't crash after all. We brought in a lot of money, and then we start sharing that difference back from what was projected to not.
Right.
So why would any department not make up a low number?
No,
and
I understand
come
that.
Come in and say, wow, we're heroes. Look at how great we did.
No, thank you, Mayor. I understand that question, and I completely agree with you. And I would ask the same question, except that I was told, and I think Chuck will support me here, that the budgeted earned revenue numbers are not numbers given by the museum themselves. We actually, at least since I got here, we would offer higher projections, and then the budget office would compare that with past performances and see what they think they could conservatively rely on. And so the numbers are brought to this level not by us.
Well, maybe give you, if I may, a little fuller. We usually work with the revenue projections with the individual departments, come up with what we're projecting based on history and what we're seeing with trends. with the AMI in 06-07, with the numbers of hours cut, they were very worried that they weren't going to be able to make up the hours because we were cutting some of their prime hours. That was their fear. He talked about my support and the city manager's support for this type of revenue sharing. What we look at in these kind of departments when they're general fund supported is their percentage of recovery. So we're watching that ratio constantly.
But let me just go back to the Arizona Museum for Youth. If it was the hours cut, then to go from 246,000 in revenue to 50, we would have had to cut about 80% of their hours. I'm not sure we cut 80% of their operating hours. So why in the world would you go from 250 to 50?
And this was its concern. And this is where I was going to get to support. Last year, we were approached with the same type of revenue sharing type of scenario for, you know, inspiring innovation.
Right.
I wasn't comfortable knowing what I was seeing coming in on their actuals to create a formula that way. So after seeing what happened in 06-07 and what we're seeing in 07-08, I feel now they've got a more sustainable revenue source, and we're not losing any of that percentage of share from the general fund. So we're not being harmed from what we've talked about on our revenue losses and our expenditure reductions.
Okay. There's obviously a flip side to the revenues, and that's the expenses. I assume the expenses then are right on target and no variation. So if the expenses went up, then you'd balance.
Right.
Is that correct?
I constantly monitor that based on that percent recovery. Mm-hmm. If they get out of whack with their percentages, I'd have the same pressure with them, and we'll have the same discussion saying that you're not staying within your expenditures.
Okay.
Mayor, just quickly, and I see what your concern is about that in 06-07 revenue estimate, and I think there was just a lot of unknowns. I do believe that AMI also was able to bring in some volunteers to help extend hours that otherwise we were going to reduce. My philosophy also will continue to be we want to encourage departments to be innovative and to give them opportunities to seed projects. However, we're also going to continue, as you can see in the last couple of years, we continue to take on more of the revenue estimate. So that number continues to increase. So the city's is benefiting because we are encouraging them to continue that trend of a positive increase in revenues, and yet we also want to, if you would, not take all of it away from the departments, but also allow them to take some of those dollars. And really the criteria is they don't get to keep the dollars just for personnel, more positions or whatever. The idea is that they are then to come back and demonstrate that they have a project or some exhibit that they believe that by using those dollars, they'll be able to continue to generate additional revenue into the future.
Have the actual subsidies from the city been on a net decrease? Or with the increase in, I guess with the reduction of hours also, they have been on a decrease?
Well, but here's how the city...
I think there's also salary increases and the rest. I wonder if that compensates for the increase in tenants.
And what your point is exactly true. It has decreased, and that's why we were willing to go to this methodology and give them some share. And further on what Chris was saying, each time they come forward with one of these innovations, we evaluate the business plan very detailed, and we make them substantiate why their attendance would increase and how what they're talking about the increase is would generate the revenue to cover those increased costs.
And the Henson exhibit is a perfect example of that. Because of the upfront cost that was required to put up well before the exhibit came, we came back and said, listen, we're willing to provide some additional funds in, I guess, the current year budget in order to bring that to Mesa because the model we saw, and I think it's actually exceeding our expectations of the additional revenue that come in as a result of providing those funds. And that's what we're looking for, something like that.
Okay. I could just give you the projections now. The Henson, the projected business plan we submitted projected a revenue of $138,000. Our current version of what the actual will end up being, it's not quite closed the books yet, but we're going to be very close to $150,000 in revenue, so there'll be a $10,000 or more additional over and above the projected revenue. And I just wanted to make one other point about some of the changes that happened at AMI. In the past, AMI was a nine-month operation because they closed down the museum for a number of weeks and months to change over to a new exhibit. With the new philosophy, new management have come in and said they're going to divide the museum into two big venues and now they're a 12-month operation. So we have 12 months of revenue rather than 9 months of revenue. So while one exhibit is being changed over, there's another one that people can always go to. That's a huge change in the way that it works with the same number of staff. So it's an example of how we are doing more with less.
Okay. The other slide I'd like to discuss just a little bit is your next to the last one on the Mesa Arts Cultural Department revenue sources, comparing the old MAC in the 03-04 to the operation in 06-07. My understanding was the old MAC had about $1.5 million in municipal subsidies, and we're about 4.5 to, depends on what number you use, almost $6 million in the new one. So even if the 83%, I'm not sure that the number being conveyed, the percentage might be down, and you may have more local, but the absolute dollar magnitude of the contribution to keep the facility open is substantially up, like four times as much. So I just want to make sure that your slide or some other portion of your budget plan is addressing the dollar magnitude of the increased subsidies and how to, over time, whittle that down.
Mayor, thank you. That's true, and this slide isn't intended to skew the perception. This is just to show that in the past, yes, dollar magnitude was different, but the portion that the Mesa Arts Center relied on for the city to support was a larger portion relative to the dollar magnitude than it is now, and that's a trend we want to continue. So we've started trending that same dollar for dollar now last year. So we will continue to bring the dollar number down if we can, the subsidy number. There's a slide I did not put on because it really is complicated. We literally track the final subsidy per person that comes in. How much subsidy does the city pay per participant in each of these facilities? We've tracked it 05, 06, 06, 07, and 07, 08, and it's going down. So we're tracking the dollars as well as the ratios.
Okay. Well, I would almost like to see the opposite also, side by side. I understand the numbers, and I appreciate that trend, but when you go from $1.5 million to $6 million, I'd like to work on the total dollar subsidy that we're throwing in from the city. And in my opinion, it went up by five times. So
sure.
That's the other
good point.
Viewpoint. And I just want to make sure everybody understood that we're conscious of that. And I do appreciate the different museums, their attempt to bring in more revenue and the seed money coming forward to be able to have those type of exhibits. The return does come back, so I am certainly in favor of doing it. But my goal still is to work down on the subsidy for arts programs in Mesa and have more private contributions and more from the participants. So, okay.
We share that goal.
All right. Tom?
Two questions. Back to slide four. The 344 budgeted earned revenue was, I'm sure, part of the two-year budget process that was adopted last year. For 08-09, we have a projected number of $344,000 of budgeted earned revenue. Is that based upon the current fee, or does that include the increase that is coming before the Audit and Finance Committee probably in another
based
hour
on the
or
current?
So. Pardon me?
Based on the current fees.
Okay. So
we did this exercise assuming no increases.
Okay. Well, that extra dollar that's being proposed in the fee increase, if that passes, why wouldn't this budgeted earned revenue number just go up to, for instance, 387, which is what you need, and not have this revenue sharing mechanism?
Here's part of what we do, is I don't give them the original budget that we started back with on their revenue. I give them the forecast that we give you back in December, so I'm already upping their percentage recovery. So then I start looking at it from then they have to justify when they're giving me fee increases how they're not going to harm their attendance, Mark.
Right.
And then we would do the same situation on the percentage of recovery.
I understand that, but you're projecting a $95,000 increase for the Natural History Museum based upon the fee increases that are, and that includes the effect it might have on the attendance and everything else. That's the net figure that you're giving the Audit and Finance Committee. So why isn't that $95,000 reflected in the 08-09 budget?
Well, because we were a little concerned that last year we were we included all those items, and I kind of got the feeling that some felt we were presumptuous about agreeing to putting those figures in before we'd even had the Audit and Finance Committee meetings. Yeah. So I made a decision this year not to include those until we at least had the Audit and Finance Committee meeting.
Okay, and I appreciate that, but I mean, the $19,000 number that's for the Museum for Youth is exactly the amount of money that you're projecting to raise by the increase on the fee increase.
That is purely coincidental. Yeah.
Purely coincidental, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, but the point is that if the Audit and Finance Committee approves these fee increases and they're approved by council,
that'll be on top of the savings.
This budget, that'll be additional savings, and you don't really, or additional revenue, and you won't need to have this revenue sharing thing, will you?
Well, I won't share that revenue with them.
Councilman, you're right.
You're not take over what they
think to put some of it.
You're right. The but practically, what we're also trying to do is what we may do from a budgeting standpoint is we may increase our revenue side. We're trying to create a threshold of incentive for them to achieve above the expected budget. So, to your point, we could do it that way. The other way we would do it is not let we wouldn't necessarily pass on those benefits directly to the department. We may want to take it more out of the reduction in the $130,000 of the contribution from the general fund. So, but we can have that discussion at the point when council, if council decides to approve those.
I just prefer simplicity in budgeting, and I don't want to create the threshold of incentive, as you described it, which is what Keno was talking about in his point, which actually encourages people to do low revenue projections.
Well, the problem is you have the budget office
not,
pressuring that number to go up.
But it's just, so. I was just looking for a simpler way to do it.
Okay.
My last question is on the last slide, the first line. My memory is certainly failing as I get older, but I'm pretty sure that when we had the list of cuts that were going to be made if the sales tax passed and the property tax didn't and vice versa, that if both did not pass, the adult class subsidy was going to be reduced to zero. They were going to be eliminated. It was like a 1.1 or 1.05 number, and I'm now seeing that in 07-08 we still have a 29% subsidy for those adult classes. That's not zero. Now, perhaps my memory is wrong, but my thought that if it wasn't going to be zero, it was going to be done away with. So why are we still subsidizing these after we specifically, as the council, set the direction that they would not be subsidized, period?
Mayor, Councilor Rawls, some answer I can give, but my historic perspective is less than yours. I do know that when that requirement was stated in the 05-06 year, there was quite a strong increase in class fees to reach that target, which resulted in a very big public pushback, which was all over the newspapers that the classes are so expensive nobody can afford it, and so on and so on, which resulted in having the center and the city having to relook at 06-07 and lower it to an affordable number, but also bring in the MCC deal, which was then to be a big savior, as it were, of that issue. Up to a value of $200,000 that they would have contributed to classes offered through MCC. The reality of that deal was that it did help, of course, but it didn't bring it up to 100%. So at the end of 06-07, what management did is they transferred some funding over from some of the other departments performing live, amongst others, into the studios to make it to 100%, which made it work budget-wise. I chose not to reflect that kind of operational figures to this council today. I chose to show you the real figures. I can also tell you that we did not budget at 100% because we know that it's a real challenge. In other words, if we make the numbers that I show you here, we will not lose dollars that we expected to bring in. We want to continue to move towards 100%. I personally don't believe 100% is an achievable target with the wave of magic wand. I just don't think that's possible, but I do see possibilities to keep driving it up. We're getting to very close to 100% in the youth classes, and we are at 71, maybe a little higher at the end of the year in adult. I don't want to artificially make it look like 100, I'm just telling you what it is now. I think we're moving in the right direction. I think great efforts are going into this. It's yielding results. I think we should give it a bit more time to get closer to 100, would be my recommendation.
Right. I appreciate the recommendation, and I appreciate the more upfront presentation. But I guess what I don't understand from Chris down, why the policy of the council, which was to have no adult class subsidy, has not been followed. I mean, the choice was to just do away with the program if you couldn't do it based upon the terms and conditions set by this council.
Mayor, Councilman Rawls, if you recall last year, we actually did bring back to the council and told you that this adult classes did not cover 100% of their costs. And in front of the council in a budget session, we took cuts out of other programs and the Arts Center to make up that difference. We have always, in partnership with MCC for this next year, had hoped that those classes would fill up, that we could get closer to 100%. But again, it's not happening. I think after Johan's looked at it for this past year, I think our conclusion is that we can maybe do better than the 71%. Will we get to 100%? Probably not. So the recommendation then, if that is the council policy, which we last year we made up the difference from other parts of the budget, which is essentially what this will end up doing at the end of this year, then we would need to eliminate those programs for the following year.
And I remember the discussion, but I remember a statement of optimism that it didn't quite do it in 06, 07, but we were going to get there in 07, 08 with MCC, and now we're not. And so I wouldn't go any further.
That's the direction of council. We agree. I think we've now had this experience with MCC for, has it been a year and a half, 2 years?
Yeah.
We had hoped that maybe some better outreach and programming, there was issues about the classes and having them filled up. I think this is, at this point, this may be the best we can, it may be able to improve somewhat, but to 100%, we don't think that's realistic.
Well, we've had strong discussions with MCC a few months ago about this year's contract. One of the things that changed from last year's contract to this year's contract is last year they were making a contribution to overheads and maintenance issues of using our facilities and classes. In other words, they were not only paying the teachers direct cost and material, they were also contributing to a rental fee, as it were. They took that out of the contract. They said they don't want to pay that anymore, and I think we were in a position of take it or leave it. And with the 100% cost recovery issue, we thought, well, okay, let's see if we can make it. That's a $25,000 difference. We had a meeting with them, as I said a few months ago, to say that's just a one-sided deal. We just don't feel that's fair, and they agreed. And so our deal next year will include the $25,000. That makes a significant difference to the percent recovery of costs. That's one comment I want to make. The other comment I want to make is that when you go into a year with the classes, our complete plan and intentions was to be 100%. And you base your fees of classes, and I know I told you that if you come and take a class, your fee will cover the costs. And that was a true statement. The only thing is that's based on if you are one of 10 students and we get 10 students per class, then the cost is covered. But then you end up with 6 students. Now, what do? Cancel a class, which is what MCC does. If their classes don't make, they cancel it. We don't do that because we're a community center that's tax-funded. We say to the community, if you enroll for a class, we'll give you the class. And that drives some of it down after the fact, which is hard to – it's out of our control. So two things are out of our control at this point. The one is the MCC classes. Whether they make or don't make, we don't make the decision. We hear about that at the very last moment. Then we're into the program. We've committed to the costs. The classes are going to happen, and then they cancel it. Then they don't pay. So that's out of our control, and we will monitor that strongly and continue to, shall we just say, represent our interests stronger in the future. And the second piece out of our control is our own classes. But we're getting better at making sure that we provide for slightly smaller classes because we're learning. It's still a brand new center. We're learning what we can expect, what sort of students can show up. It's only the third year of fee games that we're playing. I think we need to give this a while to build up. And I think we're doing the right things to go in the right direction. That's the best answer I can give you.
One more, if I can, Johan, your comment about the when the classes don't make their numbers, it's because it's a tax-supported entity, we don't cancel the class. But the direction of the council was that if the classes can't support themselves, we're not going to spend tax dollars on them. So they should have been canceled. That should have been the decision that was made, because that's what we said. Now, that policy can change tomorrow, or it can change on June 2nd. But the reality is that was the policy set by council, and it should have been followed. If the classes couldn't sustain themselves, there should have been no tax subsidies used, because that's what we said. And I appreciate all the hard work that you've done, and the whole department in terms of the numbers and the improvement and the percentage shifts. Don't get me wrong. It's just I dislike very much. We don't get to do a lot up here except argue over zoning cases sometimes and deal with the tough budget issues. Well, we dealt with them and we took the heat, good or bad, and once having done it, I think our position should be honored.
Vice Mayor.
Thank you. A couple of things. On back to that slide on page 4. You know, we hear all the time as council members that the city should be run like a business. I would tell people that government isn't like a business in a whole host of ways. It isn't like a business. However, I think this model actually reflects some of the things that we're trying to do in the utilities department and in other areas, that says if you as a department use innovation, if you use techniques that help the city, then the department gets rewarded. It isn't that you get individually higher salaries or something like that, but you actually add value to the city, and so we recognize that added value. I think that this is great, and Chris, I want you to know, I think this is terrific. I hope you'll keep on doing it. Obviously, Chuck, you're gonna watch that number. If they've got more revenue, then that number goes up. Their base number goes up. The problem is, at some point in time, your base number goes up to a point where it's gonna be hard for you to find that earned revenue. You're going to have to become more and more and more creative. But I am so impressed with every one of you there. This was, it felt cataclysmic a couple of years ago. I know, Sunny, you must have wondered why on earth you had come to Mesa.
I did.
I know. And yet, look what you've done. Look what you've done. I mean, the exhibit that you just had with the Jim Henson exhibit and the Muppets, outstanding exhibit. All kinds of attendance records. And I just got an email picture of my grandkids visiting Chicago. They live in their dad's at Purdue, and they went to the Field Museum to see Sue. And I thought, yeah, well, okay. But we had it in Mesa first. So I don't know if it was first or if they're on the second go-around or if it just lives there. But, you know, I thought, yeah, okay. But Mesa has good stuff. So, Tom, outstanding work going on there. Your volunteers have really come through. I mean, what's happening at the Art Center in terms of the volunteers, I just don't think we can overstate what kind of changes have taken place, what kind of perception and what kind of community buy-in you have gotten as a result of this. So I think it's good. We have to look at these numbers. These are great questions that are being asked. But let's not ignore what's really happened here, which is that you all have changed the fundamentals. And I am thoroughly impressed.
Thank you.
So please take that back to your volunteers, to your employees, to the departments. A couple of other, and I'm looking for more great things, by the way. One of the things that I wrote a note on the front page as you were going through some things, Johan, was that you talked about including everyone. One of the things that, and I'm not going to get too many more opportunities to talk to you like this about the Arts Center, so let me talk for a moment here. I would like to see us do more to celebrate Mesa at the Art Center. Celebrate Mesa's natural talents. We have incredible performers in our community. And I think that if we had a day that was a Celebrate Mesa Day, where you brought people to the outside, I can think of people like Johnny Wright has a band that he's had for years, and he's my age, so they play the kind of music that I like. You know, a little Chicago and things like that. And you put them outside in the evening at the Art Center where you aren't charging anything, and you let people enjoy and have performers inside. And, well, I've got a bunch of ideas there, but I'd like to see us do more to celebrate Mesa at the Mesa Art Center in ways that everyone in the community can participate. I think that's it for my comments, except please keep on doing this. This is moving us in the right direction in terms of financial recovery, in terms of community buy-in, and in terms of getting more attendance, because all of this has generated more people coming and participating in these great community institutions that we have. And at the end, that's the goal. The goal is to educate our community, to have a community of learners, and you are helping us achieve that goal. Thank you.
Mr. Cavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a comment on one of your comments in terms of the increase in the actual dollar amounts from the city to the Arts Center. I think you also need to compare and contrast the private sector contributions to the Arts Center from before and after. Before the center opened, contributions, private sector contributions to operations to the center, to operations, were about $25,000. And again, this past year, we're over $600,000. And so I think that again, is a noteworthy increase of participation from the private sector to support the center. Also, I think we, again, as Vice Mayor Walters noted, you cannot underscore the emphasis of the volunteer help. Having an organization of over 500 volunteers providing thousands of hours of support to the center is very significant to the community. The other night I attended the recognition ceremony for their volunteers. We've had volunteers who have put in over 800 hours just in the last year alone, a number of volunteers who have put in over 1,000 hours since the center opened. And that cannot be discounted in terms of the success, I think, of the center and the embracing of the community. It also helps those of us in the private sector seeking to raise funds for the center to point out the community support. So I think it's a good partnership between the public investment in it and the private investment. It has produced, I think, benefits for the community. Thanks, Mayor.
Mr. Fenter.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. I know there was a consultant study that was being undertaken to look at different models and comparisons. Do you know what the status of that is and when we might be able to see the results?
The study itself has been published, so we know what the study itself said. The study stopped short of making a recommendation. I'm not sure that it was part of the brief of the consultant to actually make a recommendation. So the consultant basically said these are the options. So that's the study. We took that document and the foundation and the Alliance had a few meetings to discuss some of the next steps, and just by way of fortuitous coincidence, the Mesa Leadership Institute made that a topic of one of the studies they did, and a lot of useful work was done there to see which one of the two models, the privately owned, privately operated, and publicly owned, privately operated models, would be the better model. And they made a recommendation, but that's obviously wasn't a group of consultants. But so we've done some work to tease out some of the models. The next steps have been identified. It will start with, in either model, we're going to be needing a strong endowment, which we've started on. We've brought back together all the boards, and they are now formed into an endowment committee. That's one piece that's on the road. The next piece is that I suspect at the next meeting that the foundation will bring back onto its agenda the necessity to start talking about feasibility studies as to, so now that we know that these are the two models, how feasible would this alternative model be, and work out budgets, work out, you know, a whole virtual plan for a different model. The problem, I think, or the challenge at this stage is that there's a lot of assumptions when you talk about both models, but specifically the alternative model will require a very strong private support, and we can only assume levels of private support, and if we're wrong, it won't work. So I think the foundation will have to play with those variables to come up with the viability of an alternative.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Richards.
I'm not real clear on the subsidy amount in relation to the quality of life sales tax. If there's somebody that could answer, like how much subsidy went to the Arts Center prior to the new Arts Center for the old center, and then with the quality of life sales tax, how much of that was dedicated to the new center?
Well, what's represented by the old center was about $1.5 million a year, and that's part of what Johan talked about. That represented supporting those classes and so forth that existed in the old MAC. So that has continued, and we've reduced that over time based on the 06-07 reductions and reductions that they took as a department this year. So that's continued to decrease. the quality of life subsidy has been scheduled for several years, and I don't have the schedule with me this morning, but it's anywhere from 4.5, varying depending on capital needs and so forth, 4.5 million to 4.7 million a year out into the future.
Yeah, and that money's dedicated towards the operations of the Art Center only?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
I think that one's debatable.
I should say, yeah, that is how it's being used.
Correct. All right. Vice Mayor.
Let me ask one other thing, Chuck, while you're sitting there. One of the things that we instituted very early on when we started the center was a fee that goes on each ticket that is in order to, so we don't end up in a situation like we had with Centennial Center where you needed to do remodeling and those kinds of things and you didn't have money. I want to make sure that the new council members are aware of that.
Yes, each, and maybe Johan could speak more to it. Currently, they are building that fund balance for the restoration, and when they start going through the life cycle of their fixtures and assets, they have not yet tapped those funds.
It was set to accumulate for 5 years before we tap into it.
And do you can you get us a number? Just get it back to us later about where it is now. And
it's close to $600,000.
I would say.
Okay. Okay. Because we want to we want to make sure that was accounted for separately, that its purpose was clearly understood, that it wasn't going to be used to subsidize something else, so that we didn't end up in this position like we have with Centennial Hall, where, you know, it was falling apart and we didn't have a revenue source in order to
we're not touching it.
At the end of this year, $706,000 is what I'm projecting.
Okay, thank you.
Where's the money kept? Is it kept in fund balances, or how does it go?
It's in a totally restricted fund by itself.
All right, so we...
It doesn't get counted as a fund balance number.
It's restricted.
It's restricted.
We don't count that.
It's
almost similar to what we have in some of the utilities. In the restricted
ones. So, well, it's where we set aside the
reserves.
But, yeah, it wouldn't be considered a fund balance number.
Okay. It's not part of any of the numbers I presented today.
Where else do we have restricted funds like that? Is there other comparables that where we do
the
that?
Cemetery.
Well, the cemetery is modeled after that, and that's, you know, sizable. That's about $7.2 million.
So that there's a perpetual maintenance when the cemetery closes? Okay, good.
Anything that we've got restrictions on, Mayor, we don't count toward what we talk about when we're talking about our 10% fund balance.
Right.
That doesn't count toward any of those because those are restricted by either law or use, council direction, that's where they're going to be used. So they're not counted.
Yeah. Almost by definition, a fund balance has to be an unrestricted reserve, so that you can use it for emergencies or contingencies in the future.
Okay. One thing I would like to clarify is my recollection also was on the adult programs that they would be fully paid for by the participants. If a class didn't fund, you didn't have the class, if you didn't have enough participants. So as far as I'm concerned, that policy is still in effect that was passed by this council, and I'm a little taken back that that's not how you're operating the center. So I hope that if we need to revisit and reconfirm that, I'd be glad to, but I think that's not our role to do that. We have set policy in that direction and expect the Arts Center to comply with that policy. So I think you've heard from us today that that was our understanding, and I expect that it's still in place. If the new council wants to readdress it, they're certainly welcome to do that, but that's not my understanding. I agree with Council Member Rawls. Mr. Truitt.
Thank you, Mayor. Being that I wasn't around when all those policies were set, I guess my question is that I understand the principle. What is the dollar amount? I mean, are we talking these adult classes that we're sitting here and debating and saying we're recovering 71%? If it's $4, it doesn't matter much. If it's $4 million, it matters a lot. So what is the dollar amount that we're talking about that is unrecovered?
Well, I think some of us would even debate the $4.
I understand that.
Okay.
I understand that. But to me, there's a difference between $4 and $4 million. And so I'd like to know, how much is this subsidy that we're talking about?
If you don't see a difference, I'd like a loan.
I understand that there's a philosophy here, and I'm not saying that I disagree with the philosophy. I just want to know what the number is.
Okay.
I have last year's number for them. I think we need to do further work on what this year's number is, but we reduced their budget out of their performing live side by $110,000 last year to make that cut, and that was that discussion we had last year.
So it'll probably be a little less than that,
yes,
just because
we reduced
more this
it.
Year.
Well, I'm not sure that it's less than that. I think the percentages are different, but if the volume's going up, are you sure that it's less than $110,000 this year? And I think $110,000 is more than $4.
Mayor Councillor Truitt, the overall budget for that program is $470,000 a year.
Okay.
That's the overall budget.
So
and so we're projecting to cover about 70% of that.
Yeah. Well, that's 120 grand left on the table.
And it's in the same order.
Yeah. And regarding this idea of the class, again, I in some cases do agree with the philosophy that you should run it a bit more like a business. I would not have a model that says if I've got a 10-student class and I fill up all 10 students, I recover my costs. Because it's unlikely that I'm going to fill it up at 10. I might have my model be if I get 7 students, it covers the cost. If I get 9, that particular class returns some revenue because I'm going to have other classes that don't make it. And that's just my comment.
Mayor Councillor Truitt, I know I didn't go into lots of detail, but I did mention that we didn't budget at 100%. We did exactly what you're saying. We actually budgeted at 83%.
I'm not
recovery.
Talking budget. I'm talking cost recovery.
In other words, if we realize that if we get 83% of students, we would cover the costs.
You would have 100% cost.
Yes, recovery. And we're projecting that 83 to at the end of the year to be 85. So we'll do better than our own budget projections in terms of allowing for half-full classes. So we projected for that in terms of our budgeting. So we did that on the management side. But the philosophy and the policy side is still 100%. I understand that.
I'm not quite sure I understand the answer.
Well, it sounds like then you have to budget for a 50% fill-up in the classes so that you hit the target of the 70.
We budgeted for 83%, as I said, not 50.
Well,
but it's not working.
That's right.
We're not getting to 100% cost recovery. Some model has to come up via experience that we can get to that cost recovery.
Well, I think the experience has been, and we can revisit it again, that when we did raise the fees in order to get 100% cost recovery, the classes didn't sell.
Yeah.
And so ultimately,
I'm okay with that outcome.
And shut them down.
And then if that is the direction of council, we will go to MCC. We will cancel all the adult classes at the Mesa Arts Center. And I don't know where they are in their schedule, but we can just tell them that there will be no more art classes. We get into an annual. The problem is we get into these decisions aren't made like daily.
Yeah.
These decisions, we enter into contracts with the community college under certain expectations that things will perform.
That's right.
So if we, you know, unfortunately, sometimes we have to step off the edge of the cliff to move forward to get these things done. And I don't think this was intended to be, you know, a counter to what the council direction was. We really thought we had been able to set up a model with MCC. I mean, that's why we turned it over to MCC, is to reduce those costs. Obviously now in the second year, it's proven that it will not get 100%. Our conclusion is, you can't do adult classes anywhere. We don't know of any city where there are 100% recovery to cover the costs that we've included. So we can inform MCC immediately this week that we'll just terminate all adult classes and then go forward from that point.
The alternative, of course, is to see if we can find ways to solve the problem we did last year in terms of the budget. But
I'm hearing the council doesn't want to do what we did last year where we took dollars from other parts of the department.
I prefer to be open about where we are now.
And I think I lost my train of thought. Never mind.
Okay. Councilmember Whalen.
Refresh my memory on how we're counting the cost. Are we counting maintenance of the facility? Are we counting debt service? Am I the same place, Darrell?
Exactly, yeah.
If we built the place, we bought the equipment, we did all that, are we using depreciation as part of cost? Because if we did, this doesn't make any sense to have equipment that we purchase that sets vacant, or space that we achieve that sets vacant.
I wasn't here when the actual calculation was originally started, but the way it is, it's direct costs, teacher salaries,
teachers, equipment,
hard material costs, and as I said, MCC did contribute to ongoing O&M, but this year they didn't. Next year they will again.
I would say we calculated, or we view it from a full cost recovery, including their indirect cost. We don't include things like for depreciation on equipment. Yeah. That is one thing we don't include. But all the fixed cost to the city or variable cost to the city of providing overhead to the MCC, that's all included in what was supposed to be direct cost recovery, not just the cost of the class.
I guess I go back to what this community expected when we opened this art center. Did they expect to have adult classes? Did we talk to the community about what the projected cost was going to be? You know, we keep fighting this battle, and to shut down the classes in an art center of this magnitude for this community would be outrageous in my estimation. To save $100,000, Tom, I understand our policy, but to do that at this point, I don't think serves this community well.
Darrell, you want to follow up?
So I like to say it in simple terms. If we were to cancel the classes, would the city be $120,000 better off financially?
And some of those, because they're indirect costs, just get added to other functions. Unless we can, what happens is over time, we have to look at those indirect costs. Maybe that means we eliminate a position in maintenance. Maybe it begins to eliminate positions in those activities and programs that contribute to that indirect cost. So incrementally, it will begin to be reduced. But I suspect that's not the majority of that $110,000-$120,000 cost. That's not what's really driving this. It has to do more with what? The supplies and teacher salaries. It's the teachers. So when we eliminate teachers, then yes, we eliminate costs.
So most of the $120,000
sure.
is probably what we're talking about.
Sure.
There may be $15,000-$20,000
right.
here that we're not accounting for because of sharing costs that
right.
that others might
overhead.
Have to pick up. And that's what I think you always have to understand. Okay, thanks.
Richards, do you have any idea what the estimated cost would be to operate an empty art center? So if we cancel classes, what would you have to do from a maintenance standpoint to preserve an empty art center? And having just seen what the community's going through with an empty Banner Mesa Medical Center and the panic people are going through over an empty Mesa General, what kind of cost would be associated with canceling classes and just preserving that building?
We'll just lock the doors.
We would still have the maintenance. It would essentially be the maintenance cost, which is really not the significant portion of that $100,000. It again, like typically our budgets, most of it's in personnel. So it'll be related to the instructor's fees and supplies, I guess.
I just want to make a point about costs and savings. We didn't talk about this year's operations at all, really. But in this year, between the Mesa Arts Center and the two museums, we will contribute significantly more to the city's budget than we budgeted we would. So these three institutions are not going to be performing financially under target. We're going to be substantially over target by $200,000-$300,000. So if we're talking about, you know, survival of the dollar, that's not a threat at this point.
And if I might make one point, in the MAC, it's somewhat self-contained. We're not increasing any contributions to them to cover that shortfall, so to speak. It's coming from one of their other areas, either by design or by practice. So you're not really increasing your contribution in any way, shape, or form unless you want to reduce what we contribute to the MAC by that difference. That's the only way we would save any money from the city from that standpoint, because we treat it as a self-contained enterprise. So I just, that philosophical point I understand, but I just wanted to point out from
So maybe it's more of a philosophy of where do you want to put the dollars within the arts and cultural department budget. If it's not in art classes, then it falls, there may be more funds available for other issues. Or is it could, though, be translated as a reduction on the dependence of the transfer from the general fund.
That's the only way.
That's what I was saying. Councilmember Rawls, and Walters, and Summers.
I guess I understand that. By the way, 30% of $470,000 is $141,000. So we're talking about $140,000, not 100, not 120, but 140. And you know, it sort of is similar to the 130 that you're having to cut from other things. But I guess I just go back to a fairly simple concept, and I don't mean to beat the hell out of it, but I think the decisions that are made by this council are due some respect. Mm-hmm. You know, just a modicum would be nice.
One more question. Councilmember Walters and Summers.
Thank you. I certainly understand and respect Councilmember Rawls' point of view. And so I just want to say I'm not I'm not disagreeing with his perspective on this, because I do believe, you know, I've experienced this over time, that you feel like you give direction and then sometimes it isn't followed. And that's an extremely frustrating position to be in. So I am not speaking not in support of what he is saying. But on the other hand, I do understand what you're talking about. You entered into contracts, you operated in good faith, and you have come back today not trying to hide anything from us, but actually to show us what happened. I don't believe it will be the decision of the people who are currently sitting here, with the exception of Scott Summers. I mean, the currently sworn people who are sitting here. I think it's going to be the decision of Dennis Kavanaugh, of Alex Finter, of Dave Richens, of Kyle Jones, and Scott Summers, what this policy is going to be going forward. We did set that policy, and given the policy that we set, if this council were still in place come June 2nd, I think that what Tom said is exactly accurate. We now have experience. We know that it didn't work. And so to follow that policy direction, this council could give different policy direction, but to follow that policy direction, that's what should happen. If I were sitting here, I wouldn't give you direction to cut that class. I wouldn't tell you to get rid of those classes. I would say, I think you're moving in the right direction, and there's a reason for it, because things are never financially simple. You cut one thing and it affects something else. In other words, you don't know what kind of money those people spend at the art store, at the Mesa Art Center store. You don't know how many tickets they went over to go and buy for a production that they now became aware of because they were there for a class. And so the spiraling effect of dollars is never simple. It isn't just a matter of cut this and it has no impact over here. But I'm not making that decision. I believe it's the next council that's going to make the decision. And I do agree with what Councilmember Rawl said. When a council makes a decision, they have a right to expect that that's what's going to take place. So I agree with what you said. May I make one other comment before I forget it about the Art Center? I've had this from numerous people, and Rob, I'm sort of looking at you and all of you. Randy, maybe you in particular. I have a lot of people who tell me that they go by the Art Center and they have no idea what's going on inside the Art Center. They want to be aware of, you know, is there a Shakespeare event going on? Are we having, you know, who do you like to go see? The guy who...
Blue collar comedy.
You know, they want to know what it is that's there, and they have no sense when they come by Main and Center Street of what's going on inside. And so I really think it's one of those things that needs to be addressed in a tasteful way, so that people who come past the Art Center know what their opportunities are for participating at the Art Center.
Okay. Councilmember Summers, did you?
No, I'm curious. Is that why you always wear a blue shirt? Okay, I'll leave that alone. I'm getting an ugly look. Chuck, you ran away. I have a question on the sales tax that was passed, the 4% quality of life sales tax and percentages. Was there a formula set up when that was passed for what percentage of that was for the operation and maintenance of the Art Center as opposed to the other uses that were on that?
No, there wasn't. Philosophically, what Mayor said was true. We set up an allocation, which we have held to, that goes out into the future, and that's the way we've operated it. We don't give them a percentage. We give them just a set amount.
Generally, what was involved in the quality of life sales tax? What were the other items on that particular ballot item?
Brian, he manages that program.
The ballot language, I'm just going to, off the top of my head, spoke to 120 police officers, 65 firefighters, community pools, I believe, and it said build and operate a community art center. It was one of the items, as well as other quality of life eligible type programs.
Now, is all the money coming from City of Mesa's revenue as a source? It was listed in here. City of Mesa was a revenue source. Is all the revenue source from that quality of life sales tax? It would have to be. So there are others. It's getting to the question that something that Mr. Brady said earlier is that if we cut here, we can transfer money to other parts of arts, and I'm wondering if that's actually true.
There's a general fund allocation, what we really call the maintenance of effort from the old MAC that Chuck spoke to, that's about $1.5 million that's been declining over time. The remainder of the city allocation comes from the quality of life sales tax.
Okay.
to bring the
But there's also earned income from the, I mean, the budget of the department isn't just made up of the $1.5 million and the $4.5 million.
Right.
There is an increasing amount, is what we've been trying to demonstrate, of earned income from the programs, shows, whatever, of the music, the whole department, and that gets added into this number. Now, so as we decide to increase or we get more revenues than anticipated, their expenditures are fixed by the budget, okay, and covered. So we may choose, as we did in this year, in the reductions, is to transfer, or those reductions actually help to eliminate a portion of the $1.5 million,
right.
Is what we've done. So instead of being $1.5 million, it'll be, I don't know,
less under
something less than that. So that's what I meant is, if we make decisions to increase fees or to reduce costs, we always have the option of either investing it back into the programs and projects, the facilities of this department, or we can continue to take it as a reduction from the general fund transfer, which then allows us to do other things outside of this department.
And why couldn't we take that as a reduction from the quality of life and add that?
But the quality of life dollars, they are...
What was that?
Restricted.
You have the answer.
They're restricted to certain elements that are already programmed. It may would provide more dollars for a pool, but that's all it would
right.
do.
Right, but there are other options.
But really, it's been the reduction of that general fund allocation that we impacted both in 2006, 2007, and then again here, because we were seeing the quality of life as a restricted fund, and those allocations have been set up.
Okay. Now, and just getting back to the quality of life issue, how is, if at all, we're talking about changing the way we track the quality of life dollars, because we've hired the police officers, we've hired those firefighters. The MAC is a portion of this, and you're going to track those differently just out of the general fund, as we typically do for police and fire. Is that going to change the allocations any? How is that going to?
I think, as we described before, we're not talking about changing any of the fundamentals of what we're doing with quality of life, unless it's at the council's direction on how we prioritize. We would just talk about moving everything out of the quality of life fund except for the MAC, so it's very clearly self-contained. And then we'd monitor through what we call functional codes in the general fund, those restricted revenue streams coming into general fund.
Yeah, one of the things we want to do by identifying quality of life really more into the public safety component is so we get a better picture, a true picture of all the resources that the city commits to supporting public safety. Because now those positions have all been hired and they're in the department. Sometimes because we segregate quality of life, we really don't get the full picture benefit of the totality of funds that are going to support public safety. And so that's really all we're, the main suggestion for us is just on the public safety component is making sure that we have a one place you can go to look at all of the expenditures related to quality of life in general.
Exactly. And from a practical management standpoint, the same economic pressures that are on the general fund relying on sales tax are on the quality of life fund. So you would be prioritizing within two funds where we can do it within one.
With one.
Councilmember Whalen.
Going back to cost recovery, we still subsidize our youth arts programs, correct, to some extent. Do you know the percentage of subsidy to the youth programs? It's not 100%. There's some cost recovery for that.
Yeah, they're on that slide.
So they are 38 and 56, is that correct?
56 and 48.
56 and 48. Okay.
But with the foundation, then they're actually 95 and 90. So it's not. I mean, there's a difference. There's a gap that's being made up.
How many of the instructors in the youth program also serve as instructors in the adult program?
I don't think anyone, Rob.
At least
two. Okay.
So if those hours were cut, you have a potential of losing instructors for the youth program also.
Sure.
Because someone's not going to work 2 hours a day versus 10 hours a day. I also concur with Councilmember Walters, Vice Mayor, in reference to the fact that I think the new council should make this decision. And I agree with Tom to the point of being frustrated by not having direction followed. I've been through that a few times myself. But I think when you look at it, you've attempted to follow the direction. And this is the first report I really had back as to where we are in the process. So I think it would be a bad move on our part, or a good move for the new council to overrule us if we chose to put that into place and be immediately popular upon taking office. Thank you.
Yeah, right.
Mayor, Councilor, well, I do just want to say, and not just to Councilmember Rawls, but to all of you, it was never our intention to disrespect your direction. We went into this in complete good faith. I think all the other pieces of the puzzle show that we really want to be a part of a solution and make you feel confident that we are driving in the right direction. This is just one piece of transparent sharing that I wanted to do at this point, which I guess I couldn't have chosen not to reveal at this point, but I just felt that I owe you that transparency to say we're making it in many other places and in many places better than we told you we would, but that's one area where we're still challenged, and it was not meant as a disrespect. I just really wanted you all to understand that.
Councilmember Rawls.
First of all, I appreciate that. If you hadn't brought it up, I was. It was one of the notes that I had made for the discussion today to find out where we were on the adult class subsidy issue. So good thing you led with it, because otherwise it would have looked like you were trying to hide it, and that would have even been worse.
No.
And I do think that there was probably a hope, not based on a lot of reality, but a hope when you started this year's budget cycle that you could achieve it. I don't think that hope should have overridden the principle.
Understand.
Okay. But now, having been the Grinch that at least rained on Easter, let me just try to say something positive, and that is that in addition to the increased professionalism and management styles and all the good work that's being done at the museums and at the Arts Center, I just want to take this opportunity to really commend the Arts Center for the National Geographic Live series that has come and is committed to coming next year as well. Those are four lectures that were just absolutely incredible, and anybody who lives in Mesa who doesn't take advantage of the opportunity to hear those presentations and see those photographs by truly world-class explorers is really missing the boat, and Mesa is very lucky to have that series here, and we should do everything we can to continue its presence. It is a fabulous, fabulous program, and I appreciate the hard work that went into bringing it here and the increasing attendance that accompanied every lecture as it progressed through the year, and I hope next year is even better.
Okay, Mr. Fenter.
Just briefly, Juan General, I appreciate this presentation. I didn't want you to leave feeling bad. I think we should celebrate your innovation, thinking outside the box. Hopefully for the new council, my goal would be to see whatever we can do as policy setters to help you to be more efficient, to provide a better service. The Arts Center is a point of pride and something very important for Mesa. So, and I appreciate the positive comments, Mr. Rawls. You're doing a great job. Keep it going. Look forward to everything that you can bring to us in the future. Thanks.
Okay. I echo those remarks and appreciate the presentation this morning.
Okay.
All right. Item number two is hear a presentation and discuss police department budget issues. There is. You weren't supposed to get one.
Hey, Brian, he needs a handout. Someone get that.
Here, you need one?
Sorry, I put them. Oh, they're coming for you. They think Jack sits there, so they weren't going to give anything to Jack.
Jack doesn't get because I'm back at the Finance and Audit Committee right after this.
He wants to recycle his.
I'm glad that the seats are nice and warm now.
Yeah. The hot seat. As long as it's not an electric heater.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor and council members. What I'd like to do is we're going to give you a very broad overview of where the police department is today, both budgetarily as well as some of the programs that we have. And certainly we'll be open for any questions that you have. I'd like to start with Lisa going over some of the funding issues.
Okay. First slide depicts a comparison between this current fiscal year and next fiscal year. Our staffing levels for next fiscal year proposed is 1,394.1. Of that, 857.6 are sworn officers and 536.5 are civilian. With the 857 sworn officers, that equates to 1.81 officers per 1,000 residents in Mesa. Our overall proposed budget is $158 million. It's important to note that approximately 87% of that it goes towards salaries and benefits for the police department. $189.5 million is the overall law enforcement budget. The difference between the police budget, which is strictly our direct cost for police, the law enforcement budget is where other city entities charge our function, the law enforcement function. That'll be your personnel, your payroll, your procurement. They charge back to us. The next slide shows where our dollars go within our budget allocation. Between patrol and investigations, we're looking at over 64.4% of the budget. The other category, which is about 12%, includes records, community relations, professional standards, our legal unit, our PIO, and our administrative functions as well. Funding sources for the Mesa Police Department. Of the $158 million, 91% is directly funded by general fund. The remaining 9% comes from grants, reimbursements, and quality of life and bonds. As previously mentioned, quality of life is now completed. We have 120 officers that were hired over the last 10 years, as well as $17.4 million worth of capital equipment. With that, Chief Gascon will talk about operational efficiencies.
There are several things that we have been doing in order to maximize the funding that we have available to us. I think most of you will recall that we talked about starting a Six Sigma process within the police department. For those of you that may not be familiar with it, very quickly what it is, it's a process that was started by Motorola in the 80s, and basically initially was a process intended for manufacturing, and then later on it was moving to other areas, and it's analyzing any particular function within an organization and trying to make the function more efficient by reducing extra movements within that particular area and also improving the quality, looking at those things that impact the quality of a product. We started by having Motorola come over to Mesa back in late 2006, and they provided executive training for all of our management team. Thereafter, we have sent five people to Motorola University for Six Sigma training. We have a Six Sigma team. And for instance, some of the things that we have done is we look at the cycle time that it takes for booking a suspect through our jail system. We mapped out the process. We realized that there was a lot of duplication. There were a lot of areas that were non-value added. We have been able to reduce about 30% of the time that it takes to book someone. I'm using roughly because it's still in the infancies, but we're looking at probably about a $300,000 savings in time, police officer time that gets translated and putting more people in the field. We started the regional fusion center, where we have all the East Valley agencies that are housed at a command center in the Mesa Police Department, where we're sharing information on a regular basis. We've now have a significant number of success stories, investigations of suspects that were committing serious crimes that probably would have gone unnoticed or certainly unapprehended for longer periods of time. We have the ATF partnership that, if you recall, we talked about this in late 2006. We got the grant. It has now been fully operating for 2007, and we are also again, have been the recipient of that grant for the federal fiscal year 2008-2009. We have anywhere from 5 to 6 agents that are embedded on a regular basis in the city of Mesa that are making a significant impact in our fight against violence and guns trafficking in the city. Our CompStat process continues to evolve. I know some of you have actually attended some of the sessions. They're open to the public. Frankly, has become a regional model, and not only regionally, but we have people from other states that have come in, spend time in the city of Mesa looking at the way that we quantify crime and the way that we allocate our resources. We're working with our local retailers in order to reduce the incidence of shoplifting by taking a very close look, and in fact, that's one of our Six Sigma projects has been looking at shoplifting and looking at business practices in some of the major retailers, not to report the crimes, but to develop business practices that actually mitigate the likelihood of the crime occurring. As a matter of fact, we are presenting at the Police Executive Research Forum annual meeting this year in Miami. The Mesa Police Department is doing two presentations, and one is in Six Sigma, and the other one is in our partnership with major retailers, Target, Walmart, and some of our other retailers. And this is an ongoing process. It's nowhere near being perfect yet, but we're certainly making strides. We are now a regional training facility. What that translates to, when I first came to the city of Mesa, any time that we training anybody going through our academy, whether it was one of our own or an outside agency, we were getting about $500 from the state. That amount later on was increased to $1,500 or $1,600. It is today $2,600, and that includes our own people, so that is a significant impact in our training ability and this money that is going to the general fund. We continue to have a very good volunteer program. Frankly, I'm very jealous when I heard the Arts Center and having 500 volunteers. We only have about 120, so I'm going to try to figure out what is it that they're doing so well so we can increase the number of our volunteers. But nevertheless, we do have some really hardworking people, and this year they volunteer over 20,000 hours to the Mesa Police Department.
And I would start talking about the proposed budget adjustments for 08-09. The first one is the police market wage study, which was presented last week by the budget office. This is just kind of a resurrection of the same slide that they did last year or last week. It talks about the current ranking as well as the proposed rate increases for July, January, as well as the COLA. It includes recruits through the rank of lieutenants.
Tom, if I could, on that slide, on page 30 of the handout that was given to us last week by the budget office, there's a comparison of the salaries for just the police officer category, not all of them. And if I look at the adjustments on page 29, our police officer range after the COLA and the two bumps is going to be 57.8 to 78,000 is going to be the range. And that is way, way above the average. And the goal here, as you say in your slide, is to be at or above the average salary for the other six major cities. The average is 50,000 right now at the bottom of the range, and the average is 71 at the top of the range. We're going to 57, almost 58,000, and 78. Why are we going so much above the average? Are we just anticipating that the other cities are going to leapfrog on us, and then we're going to leapfrog back on them?
Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, that is our general philosophy, to be at or above the market. But we also take into account simply where we fall with the other cities. And as you see, we're currently fifth and sixth. With these increases, we will be second in the market. And essentially, there is some leapfrogging that's occurred. Every other city over the past 6 months has had increases in their salaries, which has put us very far behind.
But those increases are already reflected on slide 30 from last week.
Correct.
So, I mean, if this range in January of 09, which is 9 months away, is going to put us at $57,800 when the next highest entity is going to be $54,000. So we're going to be number one in that category. And it's going to put us at $78,100 when the next highest one is $76,900. So it's going to put us number one in both categories, unless I'm misreading this chart.
And I apologize, I don't have that particular one in front of me, but according to our calculations, we should be second in the market. So I'll have to go back and make those comparisons, but that was the goal.
I'm not opposed to the concept. I'm questioning the size of it's a 13% jump that may be driven by other things, but if it's just a pure market analysis, it seems to be that we're going way higher.
Fair question.
That's all and maybe now's not the time to do it. It's part of this presentation, but it's certainly
a good question, Mayor, Council Rawls. Why don't we follow up with an HR who actually did the study.
Right.
I don't know that they're here today. And the goal was not necessarily to be at the top.
Right.
Yeah. So, and again, if you'll remember the presentation last Thursday was, here's a bunch of stuff at the back of your presentation that we're not even going to look at. So take it and study it. And that's what I did.
Good.
And now I'm trying to figure out why we're...
Well, let us follow up and bring that HR
where we are now is unacceptable. I agree with that. I'm just not sure that the size of increase that we're talking about doesn't get us higher than we want to be and put more pressure on the upward cycle that we seem to continually be caught in. Apologize for the preposition at the end of that sentence.
Thank goodness you apologize.
Okay.
The next budget adjustment is to eliminate 13.5 vacant civilian positions. 10.5 of these were eliminated due to some reallocation of resources. We had some recent retirements or resignations, and we looked internally and moved some people to fill the holes that they left, and then we were able to give some civilian positions up that were vacant. Two of those are municipal security positions. As previously discussed by the MAC, they've offered one up, and then the other one was at the South Center Complex. And the last position is the police media relations supervisor, which currently is being handled by a lieutenant. So he's doing double duty to cover this position. Next adjustment is to reduce overtime allotment by $800,000. It's important to note this maintains the current funding level we have this fiscal year. We were planning on programming extra money in for 08-09. We recently implemented a new basic and critical staffing level to replace minimum staffing. We've seen a significant reduction in the overtime hours, and we're able to give up the $800,000. For example, in the first 6 months of this fiscal year, we were averaging approximately 18,600 hours of overtime monthly. With the new basic and critical staffing levels, in January, our hours were 13,900, which is a 25% reduction, and in February, and also a 30% reduction. So we're seeing definitely significant changes in the overtime hours. And the next adjustment is for $400,000. This is pretty much across the board. Keep in mind, it's 0.25, quarter of a percent of our overall budget. We went through and kind of cut back each line item to come up with the $400,000. The next slide talks about a budget allocation for jail cost for a little bit over $875,000. I put also on the slide the comparison of the per diem rates. Again, we saw a jump in the increase for 08-09, not nearly as significant as we've seen in past years. However, it is an increase. One way we're looking at reducing the allocation is by an implementation of an ankle bracelet or an at-home detention proposal by city court. And Paul Thomas from the court is here to address any questions you may have regarding that.
Paul, why don't you just kind of generally describe it real quickly for the council?
Council members elect, it's hard to generally describe anything sometimes, but we'll give it a try. This is a concept that came to us back in September. We've been looking at it for several months, and the basic concept is to look at how much of the jail population could be allayed by using electronic monitoring. So the focus is primarily for this effort on pre-trial release. Typically after trial, when someone's sentenced to jail, that means jail, and there's mandatory jail times in the statute, so it's hard to do anything other than that. But pre-trial is a different situation. The presumption is for the least restrictive release conditions pre-trial, because last time I checked, there's still a presumption of innocence prior to trial, so that makes it more flexible. The use of electronic monitoring is being used currently in the state. They use it for felons, the felony level. Any person convicted of a sex offense is on electronic monitoring for life. So there is an extensive use of this at the felony level. The Arizona Supreme Court has a contract in place, which would be an option for us to use. We're kind of using that contract to model what it might do for us. In looking at this, we've been working real hard at identifying exactly the potential number of defendants that could be put on electronic monitoring, what that number would be, how many typical days they spend in jail, associated jail costs, so on and so forth, to get to some kind of a basic number that would tell us the viability of this project. We have some preliminary information. We've presented to the city manager. We've presented to Chuck Odom, his staff, police, prosecutors. We've visited the county probation department to see, to get the ground level view of how these things are employed and used and so on and so forth. So we're working very hard to make this a viable project. We do anticipate coming back in front of council within a few weeks with the entirety of this effort, with all of the numbers for you, with what we expect to potentially save in jail costs, what the consequential costs might be for us to do this, and where we end up in this whole effort. But at this point, we think it's very viable. We think it has a lot of potential and a lot of consequential benefit. And it is a way, if we go forward, of bringing a large part of that jail bill under city control as opposed to being left at the mercy of whatever the sheriff may do from year to year, which has been about a 5% increase year to year on the jail costs. Yes?
Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. We've tried to do some of these programs in the past. It seems like every time we get one that we think is going to work, the legislature steps in and decides that this is not an adequate way of addressing incarceration. So my first question is in regards to that. My second question is, have we assessed whether there are crimes that we are currently arraigning in city court that could be arraigned in the justice courts and thereby transferring responsibility for the jailing costs to other entities?
Well, obviously all felony cases go to county, so we're not responsible for felony cases. But the misdemeanors within the city limits basically belong to the city court. To answer your other question, you're right about the legislature. They seem to get tougher and tougher about what constitutes jail. They keep limiting the use of home detention, but that's always post-trial. When someone's sentenced to jail, the legislature's tendency is to say that that means jail or hard time. This project really is focusing pre-trial, where the presumption in the court rules and everything is to impose the least, what they call the least onerous conditions for release, because there's a presumption of innocence prior to trial. So the legislature hasn't stepped into that area, and I think we still have the constitutional latitude to do those things.
And a determination would be made that getting to one of the controversial subjects that always comes up, the determination would be made that the person was actually legally in the country before they would be qualified to be available for this kind of detention?
There are some statutes that require us to look hard at the legal status and the immigration status, but most of those are at the felony level, and I think you're looking at those statutes that exclude bail for a person that's here that may be here illegally. But a lot of that determination is made by the police department, you know, prior to coming.
We're actually have implemented a policy quite some time ago that anybody that goes through our jail, we try to assess whether they're here legally or not. Now, it's not a foolproof process. A lot of it is dependent upon self-admissions, just like it is, quite frankly, in any other system. But it is a process that we go through.
I'd just like to ensure that people who are in that program actually are people who are legally in the country. So I just want to put that on the table, Mayor. Okay, thank you.
Councilmember Gallas.
Yeah, I was going to touch on some of the same issues, but I think the fact that you're directing it toward the pre-conviction point gives us the legal maneuvers to create whatever conditions we want, because the legislature really hasn't spoken to that at all, and I don't think they will. They have as to certain kinds of felonies that you're not entitled to release. But to me, it makes a lot more sense to put somebody on an ankle breakers that they can't get rid of, and we can actually track if we have to, than to put them in jail for $74 a day or book them for $200. So
right.
I'd like to see the number work up a little bit more in the model, and obviously we'll have that data before the actual budget number gets adopted in June. But
good idea,
and
we have everybody on board with this, I think, at this point in time, and we're actually somewhat excited and anxious to bring it back to council, because in the sea of all this negativity, here is something that we think is very viable and very positive. So we look forward to coming back in front of council with this.
Well, just be careful about having everybody on board. I once had a program at the county where I went and met with the county attorney, the county sheriff, and the presiding judge and got them all three on board. And then I went and proposed it, and all three of them bailed because they didn't. They never believed when they committed to it that the other two would do so. And so it became they all of a sudden they were just going, what? No way.
All right, thank you. Next one. Pawn shops.
Pawn shops. We are looking at implementing a pawn shop transaction fee, which will be heard by the Audit and Finance Committee coming up next. We're looking at doing a strict cost recovery at $3 per transaction. The unit, the pawn unit currently right now comprised of a sergeant who's in there, part of his time is spent doing the pawn, two detectives, and one civilian investigator. The 0809 cost for the pawn unit is a little bit over $337,000. Based on the trends we're seeing, about 123,000 tickets come in a year. That'll offset the cost of about $369,000. One thing we're looking at is to do automated database. Currently, right now, that civilian investigator manually enters the data transactions. By having an automated database that the pawn shops would feed their transactions into, would free up staff time to do more investigation work as opposed to data entry. We're currently working on an RFP, request for proposal, to determine are there databases out there and what's the cost of that.
Just, Mayor and Council, she said something, it went real quickly. I want to go back to this because this really amazed me. The manual labor that we currently employ with not necessarily inexpensive labor costs to literally take the, I guess we call it a ticket, the mm-hmm. transaction ticket, and manually enter, we take those from the pawn shops, bring those over to the police headquarters, and then manually enter those into our own database so that we can use that to compare against, property crime claims. Is that mm-hmm. correct? Mm-hmm. What we want to do, first of all, is begin the transaction fee so we can cover that cost today. But really, moving forward is, and these systems exist. I've seen these systems in other communities, is we would then move to an electronic system where the input at the pawn shop would actually automatically be updated into a database within the city. So that it'd be more of a real-time, not quite real, correct. But much better than it is today where we're manually entering in the information from these tickets that then the detectives use in their efforts to try to solve property crimes. I think I've reflected that.
Yes, you have. Yeah, and the goal is to translate some of the clerical time that is taking place today and put it more into investigative time. Quite frankly, many times some of our good arrests in burglaries come as a result of doing some analytical work and what appears to be unusual pawn activity, whether it's by the nature of the item that is being pawned or by the nature or the frequency of a particular individual. So there are a lot of investigative leads that come out of analyzing the activities that go through our local pawns. The other thing that we're looking for by automating this is actually eventually hooking up with other cities that have similar systems because we know that a lot of our property crimes are not necessarily bound by our city boundaries, but people are going across city lines, so maybe the property is being stolen somewhere else and it's being pawned here or vice versa. So we're hoping to have that level of analytical work available to us. But this is a data mining opportunity for us. We work at it very heavily. Unfortunately, today, a lot of our high-end investigative time is being dedicated to doing clerical input.
Mike?
Chief, I know in the past we've had officers work parking swaps as a location. Is there anything that you could suggest legally we could do to get the park and swap people involved in the pawn ordinance?
I would hope so. Frankly, we like to at some point look at secondhand stores. I mean, we want to start with what we have today, which is kind of the low-hanging fruit. But there are certainly a lot of other commercial activities that go on where stolen property could be resold. So we want to start here, and eventually we want to start exploring other areas.
Something perhaps the Public Safety Committee could look at a future ordinance or something along those lines that would help control that.
Absolutely.
We used to control secondhand stores as part of the Here comes an expert. Joel, good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good.
Currently, sir, we do have ordinance in place. It's actually being revamped to be a lot more accurate for the park and swap operations to report to the police department. It's not set up the same as the pawn laws because pawn laws are regulated by the state. So right now, our secondhand laws in the state don't even exist. It has to be at a city ordinance. Park and swap laws also come from city ordinance. We do have it on the books. It's being less vagued, is the best way I could put it.
I would imagine you have to work those folks real hard to get them to comply.
Park and swap, well, they have an avenue where they're supposed to, if it's a non-secondhand dealer, supposed to be able to report to the directly to the chief of police office of what the vendor, or it wouldn't be a vendor because they're not a licensed secondhand dealer, comes to the park and swap, and they're supposed to give us a list of what's to be sold. That right now is being clarified and is in the process of hopefully being approved.
And could it eventually be an automated situation?
Yes, it could.
Thank you.
Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. You know, you watch TV shows and they promo all the other TV shows on their network. And so I want to promo the Finance Committee meeting that's coming up in a few minutes. And it's going to be a barn burner. People are going to want to be here because we're going to be talking about this this pawn ticket thing. And it was interesting to me. I did not realize that the other cities for years have been charging these pawn ticket fees and the city of Mesa has not. So we have been subsidizing this through the general fund. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted, for anybody who did not go through all 14 agenda items that the Finance Committee meeting is going to have next, when we start meeting, that is in there. It is number 13. So stick around because it's really going to be a good meeting. I do have one other question, it's off of the pawn ticket thing. Did you say 18,000 hours of overtime a month?
That is correct.
Okay, then if you are reducing by 25% to 30%, I did what I assume are fully loaded costs on what that overtime would amount to. If you're doing, you are going to save a whole heck of a lot more than $800,000 a year if you can maintain.
That is correct.
Because fully loaded costs, I'm guessing you're at least at 50 an hour, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
We're being very conservative at this point, but yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very conservative. Yes, in 1 month you would save over $2 million if I did my little math correctly. Then.
We want to prove it to us.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
How do you track things that are sold on eBay? Or is it one of the other computer markets?
Frankly, at this point, we don't. Again, sometimes we will go into eBay. We go into a Craigslist. I mean, investigators many times, as they're trying to track property, they will go through all this. But, you know, this is there's a lot of manual work that is involved in order to do this work. I mean, there is no currently, it's just really hard work just going through all this stuff.
I'm just thinking, aren't you really catching the really dumb criminal that goes to a pawn shop and fills out a ticket
no
with his
smart
criminal. Mr. Mayor, if it weren't for dumb criminals, we would all be in the world hurt.
Okay.
I don't know if this is more appropriate for the Audit and Finance Committee meeting, but on page 2 of this committee report for that meeting, you have 6 places that impose this fee. And it's like you had to go to Bullhead City, Gila County, and Kingman to get 3 of them. Other than the 3 Maricopa County cities that are listed here, do the other Maricopa County cities impose this fee?
Not to my knowledge, no.
So there's only 3 Maricopa County cities that do it now?
Right.
Okay. And my question is why, I know that you've got the cost of the police investigator who manually, the civilian employee who manually puts it. Why are you trying to recover the entire cost for the entire operation, including the sergeants 1/3 and the 2 detectives in this fee, rather than just covering the cost of either the software, once we find out what it is, or the manual effort of the civilian investigator? It seems to me that property crimes is part of the police function and, you know, recovering property. So just curious as to why you chose to come forward with recovering the entire unit's cost with this fee rather than the cost of the inputting?
Well, I think there are several reasons. Number one is obviously because there is a legislation that enables us to do so. Secondly, it's an area that we recognize that a lot of crime is supported by these commercial activities. I'm not saying that it's activity that is inherently criminal in, per se, but it's an area that certainly enables a lot of criminal activity to take place. When people steal things, especially in burglaries, they have to have a way to fence that property. And unfortunately, secondhand stores and pawn shops become an attractive vehicle to do so. So we're looking at an area, at a commercial activity that creates a lot of work and it enables people to engage in criminal activity. And given that we have the enabling legislation in order to do the cost recovery, and given the overall city financial situation, we're taking all those factors into account, and that's why we're doing this. And frankly, we want to take it to the next level, and we could not afford to do so today. We want to have this automated, and in order to do so, we're going to have to spend more money. But a lot of the reductions in crimes that you're seeing in the city today are the result of a lot of hard work, and the more that we can take a bite out of the activities of people being able to fence this property, the more that we would hope to see reductions in our property crimes.
Okay. We'll probably talk more about it at the Audit and Finance. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay.
Last slide I'll talk about before I turn it back over to the Chief is just kind of a review of the November 2008 bond election. Public safety, that's both police and fire, totals $171.9 million. I've listed the projects. The top three that we have within police department is the emergency radio communication system upgrade, the Dobson Police Station replacement, and the redundant public safety communications and operations center, which is both police and fire. Listed the aging aircraft, our arraignment center, our training improvements, our range improvements, as well as the Center Against Family Violence. The remainder, $67 million, is also fire projects that fire will talk to at a later date. With that, I will turn it over to Chief.
Okay. The next area that I want to talk about is not something that is necessarily on this current year's budget, but it's something that I want to start putting in your radar screen, and certainly I'm going around the community and I'm talking about this, and I have been for the last year and a half, and that is that the city of Mesa is under police today. And I have tremendous concerns because as the economic growth of the city continues to expand, and hopefully that is the case, and we have projects like Wave Yard, Riverview, hopefully the GM Proving Grounds, and the continued growth in the southeast part of the city, we need to start thinking about the policing of all these future projects that will be incredibly good for our city and for the well-being of the community. But at the same time that are going to require thoughtful policing in order to make sure that these places, in fact, are successful. A perfect example is with Riverview. We have taken a very aggressive posture in Riverview, even though that was never funded for, and we're putting a lot of police attention there because we want to make sure that people that go to Riverview have a good experience, that they do not get their cars broken into, that they're not confronted by criminal activity. So we have taken a very active steps in ensuring that that is a very safe place for us. But the reality is, as Riverview continues to grow and new development comes in, that we're going to have additional people on a city that is already understaffed for the demographics and the size of the city. So what I am proposing and what I'm talking about is basically a plan that 5 years out, starting with next year, will give us the ability to hire 50 additional officers per year and a component of 10 civilians to support the new officers. I think it's also important, sometimes we add additional police officers or communities say, let's put more cops in the streets, but we forget that there has to be that support mechanism behind it in order to have those police officers be as effective as they can. Otherwise, you end up having a situation where you end up putting cops doing clerical work, and then you're really defeating your original purpose. So what you see in this plan that I'm going to be talking about on the next slide is a growth for the police department that also includes a civilian component. And if I take you through this, if you look at the year, we're talking fiscal year 09-10, you're looking at the projections in population which came from the city's planning department. And the estimation is that the city will be at around 481,000 residents. Our sworn officer population at that point, if we are allowed to move forward, would be at around 907.6 officers. It would put us at about 1.88 officers per 1,000 residents, and that is a cost of roughly $6.4 million. And then you can see, as we move down the line until we get to 13-14, I think an important item to recognize when you're talking about police growth is that from the time that you give us approval to hire people to the time that these folks become fully functional police officers able to serve the community, it's anywhere from 3 to 5 years. The hiring and training process is easily a year and a half or more. Then the people have to go through an FTO program. And then there's a certain time that it takes for people to mature and be fully productive as police officers. So the reality is that when you talk at the end of the tail end of this program here, we're saying 13, 14, we're really talking about probably, we're talking about 17 or 18, 2017, 2018, by the time you fully realize the benefits of this growth. And you can see across the board what the financial impact for that growth would be. The next thing that I like to do is I like to get kind of give you a highlights and sort of a refresher for some of you, but perhaps some new information for some others as to what the Mesa Police Department, in partnership with our community. Yes?
Chief, just a question. $29 million. Where's that money coming from?
Well, you know, there's a variety of ways to do it. I mean, frankly, the preferred way for me would be, and I think it's because it's sound public policy, by the way. It may not be politically correct, but I'm going to talk about sound public policy, is that the community has to face that we have to have a steady funding source for public safety, which should not be sales tax based. I would propose that there would be a primary property tax that would have certain ceilings, especially for people that are in a fixed or limited income basis, so that our seniors, for instance, have a clear understanding of what they're buying into, and we never price them out of their homes because of the taxation. But on the other hand, I think it's socially irresponsible to believe that you can continue to live in a social setting and not pay the price of being in a social setting, and part of that is public safety. I personally dislike sales tax to fund policing. I think it's poor public policy. But having said that, I understand it's more popular, and if that were the avenue to do so, that would probably, for about a quarter of a cent, would probably fund this. I'm told that a quarter of a cent would probably take us to somewhere around the $30 million a year. And certainly a quarter of a cent would put us still in what this local market area is, so we would not be overly taxing our people in the sales tax area. But again, and you know, I'm not here to be politically correct, and I think you all know me that I'm not necessarily one of those that goes with where popular move is. I think it's bad public policy over long periods of time to fund public safety with sales tax.
I thank you for that candid answer. I'm not very politically correct also. It's interesting that I sat in that chair 10 years ago and proposed this very same plan. 50 officers over 10 years, and it is yet to develop. We are truly, in fact, 10 years behind on the curve of where we should be in public safety. And it's only because of the hard work, I think, of the members of your department and the city that we're in the good crime situation we are today. But I'm tremendously concerned about the future of the city, as I know you are. And this has to be a decision that this community takes seriously in the future in order to make sure we've got the quality of life. And as I leave this council, I offer any support that I can for you to help convince this community that that's necessary for us to move forward. Thanks for your input.
Thank you very much. Okay. All right, so going back to our crime pictures, again, this is just an overview of information that for some of you is old news, but I thought it was important to talk about because it goes exactly to the point that Councilman Member Whaling is talking about. There have been some significant reductions in crime in the city because people have worked very hard, not necessarily because they have been given the resources that are necessary to get it done, and there is a limitation to that. We were able to reduce Part 1 crimes by 5% at the same time that we increased arrests by 22%. There is actually a typo there when we say about 6% reduction in collision. That's actually all collisions, not fatal collisions. Federal collections actually were reduced by 45%, and that was in terms of lives. There were 20 people less that died as a result of a traffic collision in the city last year. We were able to answer 90% of our 911 calls within 3 minutes. We were able to implement and get the decoupling process, which is basically a data mining software that we're now sharing with other cities in the East Valley on board. And we have put together some significant partnerships with federal agencies, and that has had a tremendous impact in our reduction in crime. Moving on to 2008, again, as we did in 2007, we put out basically what the roadmap would be, and we put some reach goals, some stretch goals there. Again, we're saying that we're going to continue to reduce Part 1 crimes, and the goal for this year is a 5% reduction. We're also working to increase the responsiveness of our people, especially when it comes to domestic violence. One of the highlights about this year's work plan, as you recall, in 2006, I started a process of detective decentralization. We recognized, as we were in 2007, that there was still a lot more than we could do in some areas. And one of the areas that we really looked at very aggressively is the area of domestic violence. Domestic violence accounts for about a third of all of our aggravated assaults. And it's one of those crimes that is extremely predictable after you have the first notice, if you will. You know that if you respond to a household where there's domestic violence, more than likely you're going to be responding again, unless you take some very aggressive steps to try to mitigate the likelihood of doing so. And what we have done this time around is we actually put the folks that are going to do the follow-up to these cases, as well as the social intervention piece, at each of our stations. And what we're doing is, as soon as patrol responds to one of these calls, under the new program, there's a follow-up that takes place very shortly thereafter to ensure that, number one, the victim is going to do all the things that she needs to do in order to protect herself. And I'm saying herself because generally the victim is a woman, and ensure that we have a proper prosecution. One example recently, we had some young lady that actually was very thankful. She had been injured severely in her face. She was ashamed to go out, and consequently she was not going to go and get an order of protection. She was even ashamed to go seek medical help. We actually transported this young lady and ensured that all those things took place. And we were able to do this because we were on it so quickly after the original call. And the other thing is that we're going to work with the suspects also. We recognize that the suspects are not going to stay in jail for life. They're going to come back into the community. So we want to do whatever we can in order to modify their behavior. The other troubling scenario in domestic violence also is that when you have young people in the household, we know that most of the victims and suspects in domestic violence cases come themselves from households where that was an accepted practice before. So it gives us an opportunity also to start working with the next generation and hopefully have an impact in future cases of domestic violence. So this is an area that we're very aggressively looking at, and we believe that will yield a significant reduction in our aggravated assaults that are domestic violence related. And that's kind of an overview of the 2008 work plan, and certainly we're open for any questions that you may have.
Well, as long as there's a few people that are bringing up subjects that may not be politically correct or popular, I think that I would like to breach the subject of looking at new hires being on the force for 25 to 30 years as opposed to the existing 20-year terms with retirement. Somebody coming on at 25 and retiring at 45 makes no sense to me, and especially with that 3 to 5 years to be fully trained and a benefit back to the department. Our retirement benefits and what we are paying now into funds that are required for those public safety things are absolutely, I don't believe, sustainable at the existing levels if we want to bring in and have a significant workforce increase. So as much as I agree with your increasing the amount of public safety personnel in the police department, and also I mentioned fire department, I think that we need to switch from a 20-year to at least a 25, if not 30-year program for all new hires. So somebody that wants to work knows that that's going to be the program they're going to be facing. I think it's overdue. I think that with people living longer lives, that 20-year military type of style doesn't fit a civilian workforce any longer. And I think we should really consider looking at that and maybe being the pioneer city that actually adopts something. So that would be my comment for this morning's consideration. Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. I really appreciate all of the things that you have done that have just really affected the crime rate in the community. Because the bottom line is that's what people care about. They care about whether they're safer or not. And you have done some amazing things, and you know, we got to share back with you. Can we do that share back thing, Chris, based on crime rate? Can you work on that one? One of the things, though, that occurs to me is that those numbers on overtime, there has to be an analysis that's done that says if we hired some additional officers, then we could lower the amount of overtime we have. Because, you know, that amount of overtime and your ability, and maybe, you know, it isn't sustainable. We all know that all it takes is a serial shooting event and all of a sudden your overtime just, you know, goes through the roof. But there has to be some analysis that says, if we could cut by this much, we can add this many officers. And I agree with you about the dedicated funding source. I think we have a neighboring community, Queen Creek, that actually has a primary property tax that's dedicated to public safety. That's one of those things that we didn't talk about a few years ago when we were looking at various options. But that's an option, is a dedicated primary property tax that just goes to public safety. It doesn't go to anything else in a general fund. And that has the possibility of residents understanding where the money is going, which has always been that blank check concern that they had. They would understand that. But I'd really like that analysis to take place in terms of the overtime. That's a large number that you're looking at there. And some of that, I think, could be recouped by working on managing the overtime.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Ms. Vice Mayor. And there are several things that we're doing. I mean, the plan, the growth for the next 5 years, is also taking into consideration that we're going to be looking at a lot of other efficiencies. If that weren't the case, we would be talking about more than 50 officers a year for the next 5 years if the city continues to grow and the type of public attractions that we're hoping to bring here would come in. Our ratios of police officer 1,000 residents is still going to be fairly low when we get to that point. So there are other things. I think some of you are aware that I was fortunate enough to be selected to work on a three-year program with the Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Public Policy. And it's really looking at policing for the next 10 to 20 years. And in the project that I have brought to the table and I've gotten a lot of support to work on, it's really looking at the affordability of policing in the future, which will entail, quite frankly, creating very different models for policing than what we know today. And it would look at a whole host of things, including what the mayor was talking about, in many other areas, you know, the ratio of civilians to sworn, what activities should police departments continue to do, what activities should be outsourced, how should we distribute our workload. Frankly, one of the areas that we have done in order to cut down on the overtime is we're looking at a certain level of calls and we're saying, look, the model of having a police officer there within 2 or 3 hours to take a stolen bicycle report is an outdated model that makes no sense at all. We need to take that report, and if that report, let's assume that it's not a telephonic report for a moment, because certainly those will do telephonically, but there are times when we're going to be able to say, look, you know, we can make an appointment for you within the next 24 hours or so, what is convenient for you, and then we can distribute our workload more evenly and have a police person get there, take the report, do all the right things, and yet not have this workload driven by calls that may not necessarily make any sense. I mean, you know, if your cable box goes out, and, you know, for some people not having TV is probably more important than not having a bike, you know, you're not going to have your cable box person is not going to come in within 3 hours from the time you call them. You know, they're going to give you an appointment. And I'm not saying that we want to equate always public safety to those type of services, but on the other hand, there are many things that we do where the urgency of taking an immediate report is not there, but yet today we allow that to be the driver for police resources on a resource that is increasingly becoming more expensive.
All good points, and I absolutely agree with what the mayor said. I think that we have to look at that model. Let me reassure everyone who's currently in the system. Nobody has mentioned people who are currently in the system. What we're talking about are new hires that come in. When you look at people's lifespan versus the lifespan that they had even 20 years ago, we're looking at people living much longer periods of time. And so I agree with the mayor. I think that we have problems in terms of sustainability of retirement systems. And it isn't just It isn't just public safety. I think it's the whole retirement system in terms of, you know, 80 points. I know some other states have been looking at raising that number. It's a different model for public safety, but I think we have to look at that for new hires in the system. And while I agree with you, I think there are going to be new models for doing things, what we have found is we thought that technology was going to be the new model that was going to help everything, but technology costs a lot of money.
Sure.
And you have to constantly being updated, and then all of a sudden, oh, they don't support that system anymore that you spent millions and millions of dollars on, and now you have to purchase a new system. So that also has a cost to it. It just isn't quite the same human cost.
Absolutely.
Mr. Pinter.
Thank you, Mayor. Appreciate all the efforts that are going to looking at efficiencies and changes, thinking outside the box. I think you've demonstrated well here just from what I've seen that no sacred cows and you're going after it. An observation and the little research that I've done is to take an officer from recruitment to actually functioning in the field has a cost of about $100,000. That could be debatable, and maybe there's some statistics that are a little different. That's the information I've had. Surely there's a more efficient way, even if it's hiring. You know, you don't want to start a war amongst cities or things, but it's got to be more cost effective to hire transfer officers from other states or other areas versus taking a new person, you know, lateral transfer program. And I would say that too with the fire department, the idea that we need to hire a new untainted individual and then train them through paramedic programs and other things, the cost to the cities, it's just getting where it's unreasonable. So why aren't we recruiting at the very beginning trained individuals? And if it's $100,000, is there some incentive of that $100,000 cost to the city that you can catch early on to get qualified individuals and operating in the streets? So it's a philosophy I'm just trying to promote.
And just so that you know, I am very familiar with hiring incentives for laterals. There are some cities that are paying as much as $10,000 bonuses. First of all, let me say that we have become very attractive as an agency, and we are attracting people from other agencies. And in fact, our recruit, you know, the people applying to the Mesa Police Department has increased every year since 2005. 2005, we brought in 585 people apply. In 2006, it was 822. In 2007, it's 990. And we're continuing that trend. We have developed and continue to have a very good national as well as a local reputation as a good police department to come to, which translates to some police officers from other agencies want a lateral here. Another thing that we're doing to reduce some of the hiring costs in partnership with the with human resources, we've actually engaged a private contractor that is actually creating a testing center here in the Valley. And I believe we start in May, where actually police recruits, well, police applicants are not going to be tested by us. They're going to be tested at this testing center that follows our guidelines, and basically we go into a system where automated, you know, people can plug in and say what police departments they want to get the information. The applicant actually pays for the testing process, and then they get reimbursed if they get hired, and that's going to cut down significantly in our hiring cost. But getting more specific to your point of paying bonuses for people to come on the job, I'm a little hesitant only because as I have traveled and I talked to, like, Dallas, for instance, the city of LA is doing it now, and other cities are talking about it. I think, you know, we already have kind of an arms race with salaries where, you know, we want to be on the top one or two, then the next department. I guarantee you, because I had a meeting yesterday with East Valley Chiefs, and they were all immediately saying, okay, well, you know, we're going to do the same thing. So next year we'll be back up again. We'll be the third or fourth. At some point, it's going to become unsustainable. I think the same thing is occurring now with some of the bonuses and things that are being thrown out there. And my concern is that policing has to be a balance between, yes, you have to be able to make a good living. On the other hand, you're not coming for policing for the economic reasons solely. If that's what you want to do, then I tell people, you know, we'll sell cars or life insurance. Do something else, because this is not a place where you're going to get rich. It's just not there. Yep, I understand. You got to make a good living. You certainly got to pay the bills and all those other things. I'm afraid, because I've seen this a little already in some agencies where they jack up these bonuses and people have gone in, and then after a year or two, they get tired, they leave, and they go somewhere else. And, you know, then you got to get into the contractual agreements. If you live within a certain period of time, you know, you got to reimburse us. It starts to get ugly and very complicated. Today, we're not having a recruitment problem. And you know, hiring laterals is not always the answer, because many times, quite frankly, we have a higher dropout, higher washout rate with laterals, because usually people are really happy where they are. Your good employers are generally very happy. The people that start looking across the fence are having other issues. So many times those folks are people that we don't want to take. Frankly, some of our own people that left to go to other agencies that now want to come back, we're not taking them back. And they're really shocked that we're saying no to them. You know, you've already proven yourself to be below average. Why should we bring you back? So it's a balance. I'm not just saying not to do it, but I think we need to think about it more globally.
Any other questions or comments? Mr. Truitt.
Mine's more a philosophical question, and that is that I agree with being an employer of choice and being somewhere that we would like to attract employees to come. And so that my thought is much more broad, and that is if we're sitting here looking at we want to be the top two or three or whatever in police and fire, my question is, well, where are we relative to the sanitation worker and this worker and that worker and that worker? You know, I take one third of our employee force, or whatever the police department is, but that's a general question that I have, and I know that the cities always do salary studies, and they do these annual adjustments. Oh, not annual adjustments; they go about 5 or 10 years or whatever, and then they say, "Well, we need to catch up or whatever." So that's my general question.
Mayor, Councilor Truitt, it's a good question, and actually, just last year we did a market study adjustment for the whole city, and we made those adjustments as appropriately last year. I think we only schedule that every 2 years. Whether or not we can afford to keep doing that will be a challenge, but that's part of why we also employ the COLA, the cost of living adjustment, each year, is to try to maintain in between those market adjustments to keep up with the balance. But it's a fair question. It's something we try to look at on a regular basis. To kind of gauge where do we stand with that relationship to the market. And sometimes it's not just other cities. We've lost, especially in the our information technology department, we oftentimes are competing, well, engineers competing with the private sector, as you might know. So it's both, there's a lot of crossover. Both market is both in the public sectors. Oftentimes it also is in the private sector.
Okay. Any other questions? I think the topic of the salary increases, I think, is one that I would like to revisit also. I'm very concerned about this chasing to the position number one or two, and when you have five cities that are trying to be number one or two, it's not sustainable. I don't know if we have to do some type of, I know Mayor Berman has approached me on doing something regionally so that it's not just a competitiveness within the valley, and make sure that nationally that's also benchmarks are used to figure out where we need to be. Tempe has a policy of being one or two, and if you have four cities that have a policy or be or one or two, it just doesn't work. So I think that's an issue that I would like to readdress, and some of the increases, I'm not sure I believe that magnitude is justified at this time.
So, what do you think about longevity?
Yeah, that's almost gone. But thanks for that comment, Mike.
He's clapping over there, that right. Lame duck.
Okay, thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much.
Item number three is acknowledging receipts of minutes of various boards and committees. We have two. Motion. Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes. Appointments to boards and committees. I have two there. All right. I see Mr. Yarborough was one of the appointees. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes. Here reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Any updates? I will update on the MAG Regional Council last night. I chair a building lease working group, which is trying to build a new regional center for MAG and RPTA and rail, and that is being reconsidered again. It was pretty much being scuttled, but they're going to take one more look here this month to see if we can pull that off. So I appreciate all the East Valley support, especially Mayor Hallman out of Tempe. That was a great deal of support last night. Scheduling the meetings and general information? Or we have Vice Mayor, this meeting?
I still have meetings and conferences attended. We had the 25th anniversary celebration of the Federal Depository for the Mace Public Library. It's been a Federal Depository now for 25 years. Also, yesterday I went to the ribbon cutting for the UPS facility that's here in Mesa. I think we had their opening ribbon cutting about 2004. Right. And yesterday we had a ribbon cutting for their, they have more than doubled their capacity there. They're just going great guns and doing great business here in Mesa. And one of the people said to me, do you know why we located in Mesa? Because we had other opportunities. And I said, tell me why. And she said, because your city was the most friendly city to work with. Thought you'd all like to hear that. Thank you.
Okay, Scott.
Mayor, you and I were at Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport for Congressman Harry Mitchell and Jerry Costello out of Illinois, who sit on the Aviation Committee for Congress, talking about airport issues, introducing to the airport and showing them the growth. We were very encouraged, very happy to show them around, very encouraged by their support of the airport and continued support. Also on Tuesday, some of us were in attendance. We laid Captain Delaney to rest from the fire department.
Right. Let me follow up on Costello coming out. This is kind of a coup for Mesa to actually have the chairman of the House Aviation Subcommittee to come out and tour Gateway, and also we went over to Sky Harbor. And I want to thank Harry Mitchell for his work, who's also a member of the committee, to invite him to come here. We also, on Friday, we have Mary Peters, who is coming out, which is a transportation director, to visit Gateway also. So there are a lot of people that are paying attention to Gateway, and we're very pleased to have the federal representation showing up and seeing where their money is being spent. So I appreciate that, Scott. Anyone else? Okay, let's move on then to scheduling meetings and general information.
Mr. Thank Brady. You, Mayor. Just a reminder that we'll be our next study session is April 3rd, and our next council meeting is April 7th. And Mr. Summers will be serving breakfast this Saturday at Fire Station 205, which is at 730 South Greenfield. I think he's serving pancakes.
Okay. The firemen are serving it.
Oh.
Wait.
Vice Mayor.
Mayor. By the way, Mary Peters is the Secretary of Transportation,
yes.
The U.S. Secretary of Transportation. One of those times a woman does not mind being referred to as a secretary. While there is an opportunity for a pancake breakfast with Scott Summers, there's also an opportunity for a pancake breakfast at the Mesa Grande Ruins this Saturday. The SWAT folks, which stands for Southwest Archaeological Team, will be there, and anyone in Mesa or the surrounding communities are invited to attend. I believe that the breakfast is actually being done by the Mesa Grande Community Alliance, and we would love to have the problem we had last year where they had to keep going to the store to get more food. I'm not sure of the exact time on that, but I know if you show up at 8 o'clock, there will be food then. I'm thinking they start a little bit earlier than that, and Dave, okay. Well, we know if you show up at 8 o'clock, there will be pancakes.
Yes, but my pancake breakfast has firefighters.
Mine or has ancient Hohokam
sites. Or you have dirt.
Right. Is there anyone else besides these two? All right. Are there any requests to speak this morning?
No requests.
All right, then the study session is adjourned.